I am Plata on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia, at thecommentary.ca. Barry Lopez joins me now. The distinguished author has just published a new book, Horizon. It is a staggering book that features Mr. Lopez's travels to six regions in the world: Western Oregon, the High Arctic, the Galapagos, the Kenyan Desert, Botany Bay in Australia, and Antarctica. In these places, the emergency of climate change is acute. We also get a sense of the adventure that travel brings Mr. Lopez still. We read of the conversations he has with locals, as well as how he feels about his own neck of the woods in Oregon. I ask Mr. Lopez about travel, the need to listen, not just to the indigenous, but each other, and more. Barry Lopez is the author of 16 books, including Arctic Dreams, which received the National Book Award. His website for more is at barrylopez.com. Horizon is published by Random House. I spoke to Barry Lopez 10 days ago while he was in Washington, D.C. on book tour. Please welcome to the Plata Online program, Barry Lopez. Mr. Lopez, good morning.
Good morning.
I guess it's good afternoon where you are in Washington.
It is.
So you've been traveling quite a bit since the release of the book. Is that the same sort of traveling that you like doing, say?
No, it's very different. You know, when I'm working, I'm traveling anonymity, and this is hardly that at the moment. You're up in front of people every day talking about yourself, not really the most comfortable thing to be doing.
Yeah, this desire to travel, though, and that struck you at an early age. Is it something, and this is obviously the travel that you enjoy doing, is it something that motivates you still today?
Oh, yes. I'm 74, so along with everybody my age, I've suffered a little bit of a few medical issues, you know, that have slowed me down. But I still have a keen desire to travel, especially to new places.
And the other thing that struck me as I'm reading the book is and reading up about you, is that being at home, which a lot of people don't really enjoy because they'd rather be somewhere else, being
right
at home, you find great value in that.
Oh, enormous. I have been living in the same house in Oregon for 49 years, and maybe my favorite journey is the journey home on the last day when I'm out bush.
Yeah. What do you make of the fact that for a lot of people you've changed how they view home, what's around them, and not only what's around them, but the wider world itself?
Yes.
Does that bring you some, I don't know, pleasure in the fact that you've changed people's perspective, say?
Oh, I don't know if it's been me that's done it. I think there is a lot of reconsideration on people's parts about why they live, where they live, and what kind of choices they made to live in those places, and realizing that before it becomes really difficult, do they want to live somewhere else, and why? I think those questions are in the air because there's a certain basic frustration for most of us with so-called modern society. What kind of environment were we perfectly comfortable with in our mid-20s? And then what kind of environment do we want to raise our children in? So I think the questions are in the air. I think for me, if I just point out a few things and they help a reader understand the decision they've made or how they want to make another decision, that's great.
Do you think this anxiety that people feel about the future, do you think that's unique to this era? I mean, don't you think people say in previous generations felt the same way about their future, had that same sort of anxiety, had that same sort of, say, anxiousness about what will happen down the line?
I don't think that's the case. I think we are living in a unique period in the history of mankind. In previous generations, there was no such thing as global climate change or ocean acidification. These are massive problems that require international cooperation, and politically having an assemblage of nation states is maybe not the best way to address things. The tendency to want to make things work for your country inevitably means they won't work well for another country. So not only are all of us feeling anxious about unstable economic markets or the possibility of guaranteed education for our children, all of those things feed into it. And then you have this overwhelming sense of an utter lack of cooperation between countries when it comes to doing something about global climate change.
It's a real crisis in leadership around the world. And I guess when you couple that with the emergency of climate change, I mean, how can you remain hopeful?
You know, that's a very interesting question, and I'm not going to offer a smart aleck answer to it. I think the way to remain optimistic is to think more locally. What I mean is, make sure you're making choices in your friendships and in your work environment that sustain you. It's brutal to be living alone in a hotel room, for example, with no contact with people who enjoy your company, and then face global climate change. I think in order to make informed decisions about what you and your family are going to do, you've got to be comfortable with the situation around you and the people around you. So one way, although this sounds simple and maybe silly, to weather the storm and have your family come out on the other side, which is possible, you need to find a way to do something positive about the environment in which you live. We tend to condescend toward those who work locally and to overpraise those who are working internationally.
Mm.
But this situation is not going to change except at the grassroots level. At the level of the nation state, it's just paralysis.
And you've done a lot of work, Barry, in terms of reconciliation. Listening to the indigenous is such a valuable part of what people can do. And I guess that's another way that we might practice, say, that in our daily lives, right?
Oh, yeah. You can easily romanticize what it is that indigenous people offer in the way of knowledge and, go off down this box canyon where you say that the dominant culture is made nothing but mistakes, but we can all be saved by the knowledge that traditional people have. That's the wrong way to express it. What traditional people have done is always choose stability over progress. I think, generally speaking, elders in indigenous groups, they are the repository of the history of what has worked in the past. And in my experience in speaking with them, you could put them down in 12th century France or 21st century North America, and they would be making good decisions about how to maintain stability. In Euro-America, we're so eager to, quote, make progress that we're willing to destabilize what we already have on the chance that we might get something better. Children do that all the time. That's what being a child is all about, destabilizing the family environment to get a better one for yourself, But I think what's called for now is something that we've never asked of ourselves, and that is, can we choose stability over progress in order to ensure a future for ourselves? And the fortunate thing, again, in my view, is that traditional people have been doing that for millennia. So it makes good sense to go to our colleagues in other cultures and say, here's what we think, what do you think? And make sure to listen. So I think the human knowledge to create a better environment for ourselves to absorb global climate change and the other Anthropocene threats is to make common cause with women and men who have a different cultural view, and their view has so long been about maintaining stability that I'm sure in terms of techniques and raw information, we'd be much better off bringing them into the conversation.
You know, this brings up something that I've been fascinated about in terms of reading your book and the other things that I've been reading up about you as we're preparing for our chat today. The role of the environmental movement, a lot of people are questioning that nowadays because I think a lot of people in, say, international organizations especially want the movement to grow. And
yeah.
this builds into the thing that you were just saying about progress in terms of that it has to grow, it has to be international, that it has to be in every country around the world to raise awareness. And very often when a movement grows like that, a lot of people get marginalized.
Correct.
And so how do you view the role that the environmental movement can play nowadays and into the future? I mean, is it still a relevant role, do you think?
Oh, I think it's hugely relevant. It can be, of course, as many of us know, too shrill, too self-satisfied, too narrow in its view of a livable future. But, you know, in the end, we're all like that.
Mm.
I admire the energy and the tenacity of the environmental movement when it comes, say, to something like the tar sands. But the view of the difficulty has got to be met in other quarters. In other words, if you're going to develop a national policy about the tar sands problem, you've got to bring more than just environmentalists into it. I think what we're struggling toward is the new coalition, which is one that turns its back on the nation state and turns its back on material progress. And I think that's possible everywhere in the world. I mean, everywhere I've been where things are really bad, say in Afghanistan or in northern Sumatra after the tsunami hit them and killed close to a quarter of a million people in about 20 minutes. With those things aside for the moment, the struggle is universal to create an environment of social justice that, as you have brought up, does not create more marginalized people. This is to generalize, and I want to say that because when you generalize, you sometimes ignore really important points.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, I would say what we in the West call policy decisions are made in such a way that some groups are privileged and other groups are penalized.
Mm-hmm.
And what traditional people do is make sure that no matter what the decision is, no matter what the policy is, it has to take care of everybody. There is no value to a system that doesn't take care of everybody. And I think we've seen this in the West in the last 50 years with the development of the women's movement and the Native American movement.
Mm-hmm.
And other social revolutions against the status quo. They all have been a revolt against hierarchies. They have all made an effort to say, look, if men are better than women, or if white people are better than colored people, then this is going to crash, and it's not going to work. So whatever decision we make has to take care of everybody. And when you have a world like ours, in Hungary, say, or in Brazil, or indeed in my own country, in the United States, mm-hmm. where it's a kind of mean-spirited nationalism. This isn't going to work for those countries, and it certainly is not going to work for people around the world.
Right, right. The other thing that that struck me as I'm reading Horizon is you have this great skill of making friends wherever you go. I mean, it's such an admirable ability.
Thanks.
And you make it look simple. And I was thinking, you know, it's really just the ability to talk to one another better. But at the same time, it really is listening, isn't it?
Oh, I think it's more the case that it is listening. You know, if I go to another country, I'm a white person, I'm from the cultural West, I have a good education, and I'm male. So I represent, for many people, the way things have gone wrong. So the last thing people want to hear from you is how they can be more like America, for example.
Mm-hmm.
What they want is for you to listen to what they are unwilling to give up in order to work with you on a more dynamic economy. So even just to listen is a positive thing. If I go someplace and, let's see, I make an effort to play with the children, in other words, don't arrive in a village saying, okay, I want to talk to just the elders, I want to talk uh-huh. to the important people. If you show a willingness to engage socially with everybody, and if you just go ahead and do the menial tasks, if you're staying in someone's home, make sure that you volunteer to do the dishes or take out the garbage or to go buy groceries or something. If you show that you have a respect for people and don't think of yourself as better, that also reflects well on you. And I think when you create that environment, people are more likely to say, well, what do you think about this? And then you've got a real conversation going. But I think you have to show a willingness to really listen to alternative approaches to human problems, like the big ones, you know, global climate change and things. And when you do that, it's inevitable, I think, that you gather together a group of people who are much more flexible than those who arrive with an agenda because they begin by believing that they know best for everybody, which is an infuriating and insulting way to go into an environment you know nothing about.
Yeah, that's what frustrates me about people. And I'd assume that's the same with you. In terms of people just making assumptions wherever they go, right?
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, I want to say that at least in my experience, if you show respect, if you listen, if you're willing to pitch in on the ordinary daily tasks of human life, people are surprisingly open to friendship.
Mm.
And the back and forth gets really good. If you arrive with a subliminal belief that you and your country or the cultural West finally knows what's best, nobody really wants to talk to you. And in some places you'll find out later that you were funneled off to the members of their society that they have the least regard for.
Mm.
You know, it's like saying, well, we're glad that you're interested in here. Talk to these people who know nothing anyway.
You mentioned that you're 74, and I just realized as I turned 37 a couple weeks ago, I'm half your age. And yeah. What I can't help but admire as I'm talking to you and as I've been reading Horizon is that you seem to get out of your comfort zone a little easier than most people. And one would assume, because I'm 37 now, I tend to think, you know, I have my own habits and I have my own my own misconceptions about things. And getting out of my comfort zone at this point is a lot more difficult than it was, say, 15 years ago. So I'm wondering, at 74, how do you sustain yourself and have that ability to continuously get out of your comfort zone as you do?
Well, I'd like to think that I am able to do that, but I don't know that I always can. I want to be a part of the human race. And in order to do that all through my life, I've found it fairly easy to not have much to say, but just listen to what other people whose background and experience is utterly different from mine have to say. I don't think it's been difficult for me. It's been my sense of feeling common cause with other human beings, not common cause with governments or the nation state or a system of the distribution of goods in a society. I don't feel any warmth in myself there, but I've met so many people that I came to have the highest regard for, and many of those people I think I would describe as teachers, meaning I was really stupid about something and this individual straightened me out on that. So when you meet people as often as I seem to, who are just feel like solid human beings, so they feel like grown-ups. They are people without agendas, and who are not trying to climb to the top of some kind of ladder and be the ruler, be seen as the person you should listen to. If you steer clear of those people, human beings are pretty good all over the world. We just seem to create these situations that destroy us, which are self-centered people, you know, like Mr. Trump, who's not got an ounce of empathy in him for anybody, not except himself. This is a terrible person to have in a position of leadership. You know, he's selfless and vengeful and disregarding and highly uneducated, but we're stuck with these people until we dismantle the system that brings them into power.
I understand that Horizon it took about 30 years to write, that you'd outlined it originally, say, 30 years ago. You started it about 15 years ago. What do you think's happened in the 30 years since you first thought about this book? I mean, a lot of, I guess, personal growth has had to happen to write it. And I guess the one thing that I was wondering is, I mean, are you a better person today than, say, you were 3 decades ago?
Oh, I don't know if I'd say better. When I signed the contract to write this book, I had a lot of professional support to do really whatever I wanted. And that support was always there, although I explained 30 years ago, I will not write this book tomorrow or 10 years from now or 15 years from now. I need to see more of the world. I need to speak with more women and men who have grown up in an utterly different environment. I need to grow and I guess you'd say become seasoned and know the difference between things that were good for us and not so good for us. So I'd say it's a long period of maturing, during which, of course, I was writing other books. And then it's only about 5 years ago that I thought, okay, I'm I'm capable of doing this, and sat down to actually write the book and take it through a number of drafts. I don't think that there's anything really remarkable about what I've done, I didn't set out to do that. I think always in the end, the story is more important than the storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
In my own view, in the United States, part of the difficulty in our culture is people taking on life work that is designed to do nothing but make them seem interesting or make them seem indispensable.
Mm.
Nobody's indispensable, and nobody is more important than any other person. So if you become a composer of music or a photographer or a painter or a dancer or really anyone in the arts, your primary job is to create a painting or a movie or a book that helps people understand what they mean by their own lives. But the writer or the choreographer, whatever, is not really the important thing. The important thing is the story. So I never had a sense that anybody had to hear from me.
Mm.
But the more I traveled, the more I thought, boy, do I know a lot of friends who would benefit from this thing that I fell into. Was a conversation with traditional people in the Australian desert or something. But I was there alone, and it made sense to me that if I could listen to what was going on around me and describe it, then somebody with a bigger imagination than mine or who was more intelligent than I am could take that story and see deeper into it than I can. And then make the necessary adjustments if they felt they needed to in their own lives. But you know, the idea of standing separate from other people is not, I think it's a troublemaker, both for the individual and for the society of which they are a part. I found myself a year ago in a speaking at a graduation,
mm-hmm.
Asking students if they could only do one thing. It would be to not strive to make yourself seem interesting.
Mm.
I think so many people are so lonely and so full of self-doubt that they try to appear outlandish or in some other way to stand out. And they do because they feel essentially completely isolated and misunderstood in the culture of which they are a part.
Yeah, you see too much of that. Yeah, and you mentioned Trump a moment ago. The other thing that struck me as I was reading Horizon, and I'll let you go in just a sec, you write with a deep sense of respecting what you write about. Does it frustrate you when you read other writers who don't, say, have the same care that you have?
Oh, I wouldn't say frustrate. How do I convey this? I remember the first time I saw the ceiling in the Sistine Chapel in Rome,
mm-hmm.
or actually in the Vatican.
Mm-hmm.
And I was overwhelmed with awe and in the same moment gratitude that somehow in my life I had gotten to do this, I had gotten to see this. And if I did write about that moment, I would write about it in such a way that a person who had not gone and would never be able to go could imagine themselves there because of the way I created the scene. But if somebody else came along and their attitude about the Sistine Chapel was, oh, I've been there, done that, it would hurt me that something so profoundly important was dismissed by somebody who, in my view, probably was never there, even though physically they were there. They were distracted or thinking about what's for dinner tomorrow or something. So there's room for everybody to write whatever they want about a place, but if you have no respect for the place, maybe it would be a good idea not to try to write about it. Mm-hmm. Because, right at the start, you know that you don't know enough to write about the place. And, I would say that that's a trouble for us in the West across the board. Mm-hmm. The things that are not our own, we tend to ignore or to disparage. But that's the heart of racism and colonialism, of course. My thought would be, what is the point of criticizing and demeaning something? Why wouldn't you invest that energy in trying to understand something that it is beyond your own understanding or just utterly new? Mm-hmm. I often wonder why, if something leaves us in a state of awe, isn't that enough? Mm. Do we need to improve it or comment on it?
Yeah.
No, we don't. I think related to this is the question of having a positive attitude to everything that is non-human, instead of a condescending attitude. The world is full of mystery none of us will ever understand. And at some point, it's quite enough to just say that when you encounter something larger than your own imagination. And be grateful that you got to see it.
Yeah, Barry, I could talk all day with you. I've so enjoyed our chat and reading this book, especially. It's such a beautiful book.
Thank you.
Congratulations on its publication. Continued good luck with it. And I must say, I'm extremely grateful for the chance to talk to you. Thank you for this, Barry.
Wonderful. Thanks very much.
The website for more is barrylopez.com. Horizon is published by Random House. Barry Lopez joined me on the line from Washington, D.C. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.